chairperson, item 2, we have to elect a standing chairperson, so can I call for any nominations? Thank you.
Attend to your committee engagement. I think it will fit. Let me take this opportunity to welcome among our midst the leadership from the National Treasury, led of course by Ishmael Mumiat, affectionately known as Momo. Momo and your team, you are welcome. Members, a special word of welcome. I think this is our first sitting in the new year. I know we had some oversight engagement earlier, but I think this is our first sitting, and I hope that the members, we are appropriately rejuvenated, I mean, to tackle, I mean, our assignment as public representatives. I think we all have the necessary energy to attend to our assignment expeditiously as expected, because this year is going to be a very hectic year in the political landscape of our country. As you are all aware that the ruling party is having a policy conference which is giving shape to our work here, but also an elective conference towards the end of the year. So I hope we are well rejuvenated to take up our assignments, I mean, for this year. We have received apologies from certain members. As I said earlier, the chairperson is one of those. We received an apology from a member from COPE, Honorable Koronov, and we haven't heard anything from the official opposition. Honorable Chetha is expected to join us in due course. And from the IST, Honorable Singh, apologize, we haven't heard anything from Honorable Ambrose Singh. And we also receive apology from ACDP, Honorable Soft. Those are apologies that have been tendered officially. As I said, Honorable Chetha will be joining us very soon. Honorable members, colleagues, as well as the team from the National Treasury, as you are all aware that our overall economic and fiscal context, that is the one that we operate within, enjoins us from time to time to look in retrospect on some of our best and worst practices. With, of course, the wisdom of hindsight, we are able today to tease out some of the wrong decisions made leading to the global financial crisis. And by the way, we are still continuing to experience this challenge. If I may cite some of the pertinent or current examples, let's look into what is happening in Greece. I mean, all of us will agree that our system in some of the developed countries and also in some of the developing countries are very chaotic. Financial systems are very chaotic. If it is cited, if it's true what is cited in the media, that one of the 4,000 debtors, I mean, to Greece government is a shepherd, then it clearly tells you that really how some of our financial system can be chaotic. And also, I mean, the rate at which incidents of insider trade are brought to the attention currently. Even here at home, I mean, there's a third case that our own stock exchange was dealing with. I know there is that particular submission that it's not related to insider trade, it's something else. But insider trade incidents are very, very dominant in the media and reported in the public domain. And also, these developments, I think, to us, single out the state of affairs that our financial markets, I mean, find themselves. Then it becomes imperative for all governments to ensure that appropriate regulations are in place. And in our case, I think we seek to comply with this noble cause by inter alia introducing the two bills. That is the credit rating ratings service bill, which among other things attempts to regulate the credit rating space, which has hitherto been unregulated. And secondly, the other bill that we are to do in attention, the course of our sitting here, will be financial market bill, which is meant to plug on gaps realized in the Securities Services Act that has been regulating the space of security services. So to take us through some of the details that we will be looking into as we kickstart this process, Momo and his team will give us the details through a presentation. And at a later stage, I think members will then be afforded an opportunity to get some directly speaking questions. This is, I must emphasize, this is an informal briefing that we have requested and a very critical briefing on these two topical bills. So I think we will be flexible in terms of our approach, because this presentation are treated as two different presentations. So maybe we will take the first presentation and allow for clarification questions on the first presentation. And I think that will be the order in which we will be approaching this presentation. Mom, I hope you are ready to take up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for inviting us.
Thank you very much, Mother. And my name is Roy Hoven. I'm Acting Chief Director of Financial Stability and Markets.
Okay. So I'm Ishmael Moronia, Head of Tax and Financial Sector Policy in the Treasury.
Good morning, I'm Ria Alexander. I'm from the Legal Department at the Financial Services Board.
Good morning, I'm Norman Miller. I'm the Head of the Department of Capital Markets at the Financial Services Board.
Thank you, Chair. I think just in going through these bills, and before we get to the first one, we'll start with the Credit Rating Services Bill. But I think just to remind ourselves about the context of these bills, I think, firstly, Chair, you alluded to the financial crisis and the need to strengthen our financial regulatory system. And as you're aware, in the budget in February last year, the Minister tabled this document, the Safer Financial Sector to Serve South Africa Better. And we did brief Parliament, I think it was in September, on this bill. And, on the framework that we're looking at to improve the regulatory system over the financial sector, which, as I said, is not very different from a nuclear facility. The financial sector has lots of benefits, but if you don't regulate it properly, you just need one explosion, only once, in 30 years to destroy almost all the benefits of 30 years. So it's like a nuclear facility. You've got to make sure that it's regulated effectively, and that you don't become lax at any point in time on the regulatory system. And because of the global financial crisis, I think this is an area that's now the focus of lots of international meetings, because obviously you know, probably more than any other sector, the financial sector is more globally integrated than I would imagine any other sector. If they tighten standards of British banks, you can be certain we will also have to do so. Sometimes if only because two of our banks have their controlling companies in the UK, they are forced to make changes to their subsidiaries. But also for other reasons, that if you want to trade with the rest of the world, you do it through the financial sector. And if our standards are not on a par with our trading nations, your ability to transact is seriously impeded. So there's lots of demands, I think, just from the global situation to reform and improve our system. And I think it's for that reason that when we produce this document, we outline a whole host of these reforms. And I want to just remind us that a lot of the reforms here will take time to implement. We're hoping that the first bits of legislation from this will be presented to you next year. And that this year what we're still doing is to refine the framework. We're going to have to say, and if you move on to remind ourselves, the next, is one of the key proposals is to develop a twin peak approach. The one focusing on prudential, and prudential generally is responsibility for the financial soundness of the institution. And if you go beyond the regulator, because this goes above the regulator, for what we call macroprudential stability, just to get systemic stability. Because if one bank goes, for example, one of the four big banks, they are too big to fail, you can be certain all the other banks will fall like dominoes. And that's and that can bring down the whole economy. The kinds of problems here you alluded to increase, although there was no failure of the banks as such, but a lot of these problems have been sparked, in a sense, from 2008 when Lehman's bank went down, and we're seeing that we're still in the grip of this crisis, now in the shape of the euro crisis that you see. And this is really like a disease. If you don't treat it, it spreads, and it spreads to the entire economy. And you need to deal with it quite decisively when you have this problem. So the prudential regulators have really a critical role to play at the cost of being unpopular. The other regulators that we recognize that although we've got quite a sound prudential system, which is not to say it's a perfect system, but we felt that on the market conduct side, the issue of protection for investors, for protection of policyholder funds, be you a depositor in a bank, be you whether you have a pension. The financial sector is different. If you have a pension today, you need to know that in 40 years' time when you retire, I know many of us are not that young anymore, so it will be sooner, but say in 40 years' time, your pension is actually going to be in a position to pay out. And so, although that itself is a prudential issue, the market conduct issue is, how is your pension fund dealing with you now? How are you being informed? What's been disclosed about charges? So that you know exactly what's going to happen in 40 years' time when you get paid out. And that when you get paid out, you don't find that you forgot about inflation, and in fact the money that you've saved for so hard, it's literally worth nothing because you didn't take into account inflation, for example, or the charges were so high that your growth was very little after you take into account inflation. So that's a big reform that we had in mind. Now, I want to emphasize the bills that we have today, therefore, cannot preempt the changes that we're going to make. If you look at the bills today, we can't say this falls under prudential regulator or this falls under market conduct regulator. Currently, both our regulators, or all our regulators, tend to play all these roles, except for the banking registrar. So when Norman sits, he's got to do prudential and market conduct in the FSB. Now, the difficulty we face is you're making this big reform. You can't, in the meanwhile, allow things to fall apart. So the bills that you have largely address urgent gaps that you have and that need to be filled. Yes, down the line, not just this legislation, won't be changed too much. It will be changed in the sense of you'll begin to differentiate between the prudential and market conduct regulators, etc. So these bills that you have today, only to the extent that it's possible to preempt the changes, that's been incorporated. But to the extent that you're going to have a prudential and market conduct regulator, that's not been done in today's bill, because it's not possible to do it until we finally complete our legislation. But the call we've had to make is some of these changes are really quite urgent, and we should, in fact, go through with some of these amendments. I think that's quite an important point to bear in mind. So we are trying to also implement some of the, well, internationally, the tougher rules that you have. So for banking, you'll have legislation on the Banks Act amendment, which will not even deal with Basel III, but Basel 2.5, right? 2.5. Insurance, there's a Solvency II reform, which also tightens the prudential regime. If you go to the international meetings, the whole issue of OTC derivatives, which means over-the-counter derivatives regulation, because a lot of your transactions in derivatives are done over the counter and not through an exchange, so you don't really know the risks involved. There's a lot of moves to deal with them. And then, of course, to regulate credit rating agencies. Generally, they've been allowed to operate without any legislation. And you'll find that whether it's the United States, the EU, all these countries now are seeking and have legislation in place to regulate credit rating agencies. And these relate to their governance, it won't deal with the harder issues of how they are rating down economies and whether they're doing that properly. Or whether they should have done it is one set of issues. But the process for doing so, is it fair, it's free of conflict? That's what these bills attempt to deal with. The rating agencies can still downgrade you as long as they do so through a proper process. So I think that in looking at the two bills, essentially, the credit rating services bill is a new bill. We've not regulated through formal legislation credit rating agencies. But the financial markets bill is not entirely a new bill, and that's why you'll see that the bills you have today, what we've given you is the presentation, but we've given you the two bills. I should say that the credit rating services bill is the certified copy. The financial markets bill is still being certified by the state law advisors. We hope to get that certification. I was hoping it would have been done already today, but it will be done in the next few days, hopefully. And certainly these bills still need to be formally tabled. So hence this is still an informal session. But even the financial markets bill is not going to be amended seriously from the version that you have. But I want to point out it's not in the final certified form that's required by Parliament. So you have the bill. We've also given you two explanatory memorandums. One that explains the credit rating services bill. And on the financial markets bill, because it's not entirely a new bill, a lot of the changes are amendments to the current Securities Services Act, and that's not intelligence, the National Intelligence Agency. It's securities as in shares, okay? And in fact, that's one reason why we're changing the name, because it causes confusion when you say Securities Services Act. And what the explanatory memo shows is what are the changes compared to the Social Services, the Securities Services Act. And that's because I think that we felt that some of the changes are so extensive that to try and give it to you in a normal amendment form would have probably made it very difficult. So we just decided that it's easier just to replace the bill, even though the basic foundation of that bill is still intact to some extent. So I think that's the background that we have. I'm going to ask my colleagues here and Roy just to go through the specific bills. But I think before we do also, and we'll deal with this later, what has driven the changes to these bills? Well, it's largely, I don't know if you want to jump to financial market side, so we can just go through it. But largely, as I said, internationally, go to slide 23. Internationally, there's been a lot of discussions. As you know, South Africa is now a member of the, and when we say, firstly, is a member of the G20. As part of the G20, the approach taken is that because the crisis started in some of the G20 countries, like the United States, and then spread to Europe, that the G20 should really lead in terms of learning from the lessons of the crisis and improving the quality of financial regulation. And all countries have generally, when the heads of state have met, have committed themselves to tighter capital requirements for banks, for reforming the OTC derivatives market, for regulating credit rating agencies. So this has all been done through broad commitments of the G20. And I think if members would like, if you go into the G20 website, you'll see that when the heads of state met, there'll be in their resolutions since it started meeting in 2005, in November or December, I think, was the first meeting, that you'll see that there are resolutions on improving the financial architecture. A lot of that has been driven through a body called the Financial Stability Board, which comprises of the G20 members, and in addition, a few important financial centers like Hong Kong, Singapore, Switzerland, countries that aren't members of the G20, or like Hong Kong, are part of a bigger country like China. But they are invited specifically to come and represent these important financial centers. And what you find, again, in the FSB, and again, they too have a website which kind of details the much more detailed papers that are there. In fact, there are so many papers that even we as a department struggle to go through the excellent technical papers that are there. But between us, the Reserve Bank, Financial Services Board, there's an attempt to obviously keep up with the plethora of technical recommendations and work that's been done. Now, in addition to that, you have a body called IOSCO. Norman, what does it stand for? International Organization of Securities Commission. Okay, Commission. Now, what you find is, perhaps you've heard of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. That's the committee of all the banking supervisors of again, largely the G20 members and a few other countries. So you find that in insurance, there's the International Association for Insurance, what's it? IAIS. Okay. And then for capital markets or for the security sector, you find there's IOSCO, which brings together the key financial markets in this international body. And what you'll find is that all of these bodies have developed a set of principles or standards that all members should comply with. I don't know, we haven't recirculated the standards, but but that has the standards anyway. And so when you have the JSC operate, it needs to operate in terms of the standards that are there. But the standards then apply obviously to the Financial Services Board as a securities regulator. And what you find is that if you link it to the FSEC, every 5 years now, the IMF and World Bank conduct what they call an FSEC, which is a financial sector assessment program. Okay, you can see even I'm finding it hard to follow all the abbreviations. But these FSECs are now done every 5 years, and our standards are kind of, we get scored by what they call a ROS. Okay, do you remember what the report on standards compliance? Okay,
and code.
And code. Sorry. So what they do is that they come every 5 years, and through the G20 we've now made it every 5 years. They test whether we comply with the standards that we've agreed to in IOSCO, in the G20, but effectively around IOSCO, because that then gives effect. So they conducted this in 2010, and we published the report, and check this, you know, is an area that's worth looking, and in fact that's why we circulated the FSEC. So the FSEC would cover how do we meet Basel standards for banking, how do we meet insurance standards for our insurance industry, and this is on the website, the Treasury website as well, but we've just printed out the one for financial markets, and I think it's just useful to go through it because just to get a flavor of what they do. So if you go through this, you know, you'll see that they'll talk about, you know, they've been nice to us and say we've made substantial progress, because there was also a previous FSEC done, I think it was in 2000, yes, 2000. And so, firstly, when they make recommendations, they first say, how much progress have you made against those recommendations? And you'll see that although we made lots of progress, there are areas that perhaps we didn't make as much progress as we like. Okay. It's this report here called South Africa Detailed Assessment of Implementation on IOSCO Principles Securities Markets. Okay. And you know, it's really worth a read, and I would urge members to read this because it also gives you quite a nice background if you look at page 5 and 6 about how our system has evolved. You know, they even go back to when FSB here in South Africa was established, how it functions, and points out, for example, that we have more than just one regulator that applies, or one department. In fact, something picked up in the Red Book, that on the one hand, even under the Minister of Finance, there's a plethora of institutions, okay? But you'll find that, because aside from the Financial Services Board, and not that it's under the Minister of Finance, you've got the Reserve Bank, but let's say in the financial sector, you've got the Accounting Standards Board, what else do we have? You've got the FIC, you've got quite a few, and to some extent even SARS you could put in that camp, financial regulators or whatever that come in. But in addition, you've got the National Credit Regulator that falls under DGI. And importantly, you've got the Companies Act, which falls under DGI. Now, how do you ensure coordination not between these agencies? It's tough enough when they even fall under one minister. And that's not just in South Africa. I'm referring to in the world. You found regulators, you know, are obviously doing their work, but if they work in silos, you can get a financial crisis. So is a banking regulator talking to the insurance regulator, especially when you have a company like, if you take Old Mutual, which has a controlling share in NetBank, it's got a bank and it's got insurance. And it will do pensions as well. So you've got to get, even within the FSB, I have to ask, does the insurance regulator in the FSB registrar talk to the pensions registrar? Now, I know Dube Shidi, the registrar, will talk to himself, but his deputy registrars who actually kind of do the regulation, do they talk to each other when they assess or regulate a company? And one of the big areas is how do we regulate the groups that own these different types of companies, because they all have different standards that apply. So I just want to point out, it's tough enough at the best of times. Anyway, it's a good history, and I would really recommend that members read through pages 5, 6, 7, and 8 at your leisure time. But what I want to point to is if you get to page 11 and 12. Now, they've been kind to us, but they tell us where we're failing. Okay? So you'll see that they give us a rating of an F1, of a B1, etc. Okay? What is F1?
Fully implemented.
Okay. Which is fully implemented. So it's not a bad mark. Okay? BL is broadly implemented. Others they couldn't rate. And somewhere you might have partial implementation or no implementation, okay? So, Chair, when you want to hold us to account to the Treasury and FSB, I would suggest you look here because there's a score sheet here which says where we've passed or failed, or just done, not done too well. And just to go through it, I mean, for example, if you look at the principles on your left, those are the IOSCO principles, and these are evolving. At the moment, we're sitting with what? 26 principles. Sorry?
38.
They're increasing in number. But at the time, there were certain principles against which we were assessed. So, for example, they'd say the responsibilities of the regulator should be clearly and objectively stated, and they say the South African system of financial services regulation is complex, involving multiple government agencies, several advisory and oversight committees, and several self-regulatory organizations. It will say, principle two, the regulator should be operationally independent and accountable in the exercise of its functions and powers. Now, although it's been broadly implemented, it says that the FSB has full control over its budget and daily operations. However, the Minister of Finance has a legal authority to hire and fire board members and FSB executive staff. Now, it doesn't actually do that, but they are worried in their legislation that your regulators are operationally fully independent, which means that they've got to have their own budget. Now, if you look at their own budget, Chair, there's hard issues here, of course, because we might not always agree. We would say, but you need to be accountable to Parliament. Parliament needs to approve budget if there was a budget allocation. In this case, the FSB imposes levies, so Parliament doesn't even look at its budget. I would contend that there needs to be some accountability by the FSB to Parliament, even in that respect. But how do you do it without breaking the rule of operational independence? There's issues about how does the regulator get appointed. How does the board get appointed? When they make unpopular decisions, can the minister or the president just fire them? Those are all hard issues that we need to show in our legislation that our regulators are independent and cannot just be fired because they've made unpopular decisions. So they're very important issues that crop up, which when you look at the legislation, Chair, and how they report to the minister, etc., all of those you need to take into account these principles. And that's why I'm highlighting these principles. So, you know, I won't go through all of them. I mean, and in fact, one of the tests, and Norman can deal with this at another time, is to what extent do these bills are meant to address some of these gaps. Now, as I said, they're not going to deal with all of these issues, because the issue of the FSB's budget will be dealt with in separate legislation around the FSB. But the point is, we're not going to do it over the FSB. If we're having twin peaks and the FSB becomes a market conduct regulator, we'll do it for the new market conduct regulator. So that's the thinking. So some of this will be implemented in perhaps 2 years' time, or say next year, rather than this year. Some of the issues which are more deal with the financial markets directly, we're hoping to deal with this year. So, for example, if you look at Principle 3, they'll say the FSB lacks regulate in the middle, the second sentence. The FSB lacks regulatory authority to set disclosure requirements for public companies. Public companies are your listed companies that you have. Okay? And in fact, in South Africa, the model that we have is that the JSE, and it's a good model, is called an SRO, a self-regulated organization. Okay. But just because they're self-regulated doesn't mean that the FSB has no power. It should have some powers. And you'll see in a financial markets bill, when we talk about it later, that is addressed about they are self-regulated, but if they don't regulate according to certain standards, the FSB can step in to the extent that it's appropriate. So, you know, I think, Chair, and I don't want to overdwell on this, but you need to look at all these tests, and at the end we need to say to you, we're dealing with this principle, we're not dealing with that principle. That's going to be important. I want to just bring to your attention on page 12, because there is some important issue. You know, Principle 8 looks at the regulator should have comprehensive inspection, investigation, and surveillance powers. So this is not light touch regulation. Even if the Johannesburg Stock Exchange is a self-regulated organization, they have to meet standards. The FSB must still have strong inspection powers. And look, what was the verdict here? The FSB has strong inspection and investigation powers, and the JSE provides it with surveillance capacity over the listed market. Now, even though that's the case, the FSB still needs to oversee the JSE and make sure they're doing it properly. You can't just delegate this away. So, you know, these kinds of issues, although it's not raised as strongly as a problem, the standards also get tighter and we are expected to implement it. And then I want to bring your attention to, you know, there's a whole lot of enforcement issues, but to go back to, where do they talk about the financial reporting standards? You also have to make sure that when Norman regulates the JSE, he doesn't get gifts from the entities. That's Principle 5. So some of this might not require changes in the law, but is the FSB, has it got a clear policy on gifts? Does it actually say to Norman, you can't even receive a bottle of this or that from the people you regulate? Or if you can receive it, this is the limit. And some regulators are much tougher than others. I was saying, if you look at Principle 3, I think that's also important, because if you read the bottom of the line, the responsibility is assigned, if you look at on the disclosure requirements, the DTI for all companies and to the JSE. You know, the GTI is an important player, and I hope the members who are from the other committees are from the Trade and Industry Committee as well, Chair. And in fact, if you read this report, you will see that some of the concerns they highlight is that in the Companies Act, some of the provisions do need to be implemented. If you turn the page on page 15. So if you look at recommended action, so if you turn over, you'll see, you know, there are some issues, and then they actually are quite strong that there are gaps that we have to fill. So if you go to on page 15 at the bottom, and I've dealt with this, the way the law is crafted, they feel that there's unlimited discretion of the Minister of Finance. So that in the legislation that we come on to impeach, we'll have to limit it in the law. Okay? That's no longer acceptable. So if you look here, you'll see the recommended actions. Or if you look at Principle 14, it says the JSC, the Joburg Stock Exchange, should proactively monitor ongoing periodic company disclosure report. If the DTI does not implement its legal responsibility to monitor compliance by public companies with the Companies Act, this authority should be legally transferred to the FSB. Or if you look at Principle 16, it will say DTI should quickly create the Financial Reporting Standards Council and provide it with sufficient resources to perform its responsibility. Now, Chair, why am I raising these issues? I'm just pointing out that your regulatory system will not be effective unless the Companies Act is fully implemented. It's a very good act. That the structures that it has are fully implemented. And the tough questions you have to answer is, if you then have a Financial Reporting Standards Council, where does the Accounting Standards Board, for example, fall in? These are issues in all countries, so it's not just a South Africa-specific problem. But the issue is, do these various regulators talk to each other? So I'm hoping that you will exercise your oversight jointly with the Trade and Industry Committee, because it's no point us tightening up here and then there's a leeway out because an enforcement agency in terms of the Companies Act is not working. And similarly, it's no sense if they are tough and then we undermine the legislation that we have from a trade and industry perspective through this. And why I also raise it is because you'll see that in our legislation, there are some important issues then, Chair, and I'm going to now come to an end of this thing. That, so not in implementing EPSAP, and what we haven't written here, it's in another slide, the fact that the Companies Act has changed has forced us to make a whole lot of changes. And in fact, you will have another bill which we're tabling just to deal with the changes made. Or because we have the new Companies Act, you have to change references to the in the Act to the new Act. You have to make lots of changes. So we're giving you, we're coming with a massive bill called the Financial Services General Laws Amendment Bill, which will cover the Pensions Fund Act, which will cover, you know, all these acts. And that's why also for the Banks Act we have to do that. And Chair, we have to do it all this year. We also have to take into account the Consumer Protection Act, because generally we've argued that the financial sector must be held to higher standards than just ordinary consumer protection. If I sell you a vacuum machine, the Consumer Protection Act can cover very quickly that when you take the machine home, it doesn't work, there's a warranty, the Consumer Protection Commissioner can deal with it. They can't deal with when you have a pension, because you're making your contribution, as I said, at age 20 or 30, you're only going to get the money when you're age 65. So somebody has to check every year that your pension fund is sound. Your trustees are not stealing funds, so that by the time you retire, you only find out then that there's a problem. And that's why in the financial sector, we ask for, you know, higher standards, disclosures. If you take those funds, if you have fees that you haven't declared, there are strong sanctions and so on. So we have to deal with the Companies Act, the Consumer Protection Act, even competitions legislation has to be dealt with, like when you have an emergency. Like what I said is, when there's a financial crisis, you have to have emergency provisions, like say if there's a run on a bank. You need to act. You can't wait to have normal insolvency legislation that applies. Because by the time you institute that over 2 years, in fact, in a day, the money will be gone from the bank when people withdraw their money. And as you might have seen with Northern Rock in the UK, you know, by the time the queues are outside the banks, you can be certain that the companies have moved much faster and taken out the big money. And it's only ordinary people who will actually suffer. And then, I think just to end, there's other conventions we have to deal with, which is the Unit Rights Convention, which is something led by the United Nations. I don't know who wants to talk through Unit Rights. Norman, you can maybe just say what it is about. Okay.
Yeah, that is, I think private law that also deals with finality of settlements within the financial system, as well as insolvency. That if there's any insolvency within a company or listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, then the rules of the exchange, as well as the Central Securities Depository, must be very specific in terms of how are we going to deal with the insolvency and the outstanding obligations in terms of settlement within the settlement system, so that people know exactly at what point those transactions put through the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and straight to Central Depository will be settled. So it is also very important that Unitroid deal with finality of settlement. Within the Financial Markets Bill, we have introduced a number of new sections that will also be incorporated within the rules of Strike, the Central Depository. I think the OI will also, when he goes through the bill, will point out which sections will be introduced as a result of the Unitroid Convention. And I'm very glad to say that when we assess the compliance by South Africa in finalizing the financial markets bill, that we are more or less complying with all those main principles agreed by the various countries in terms of that convention. Then while I'm having the mic, I just want also to refer to the ESCAP that Momo has dealt with very comprehensively. That is very important. And we have tried to introduce all the weaknesses and the gaps in our legislation in terms of the findings of the ESCAP. And the feedback received from the assessor from America, it was a former secretary of the Securities Exchange Commission of America that assessed South Africa in 2010, his feedback was extremely positive. And the feedback to South Africa is that this ESCAP findings was one of the most positive outcomes that this guy was involved in. So I think it was a very positive and a very good outcome for South Africa. And some of the main weaknesses we've already addressed in the financial markets, so like the regulator must approve formally the listings requirements of an exchange, not just consult with the exchange. We've already dealt with that. Momo mentioned proactive disclosure, monitoring and surveillance by the exchange. We've already introduced various mechanisms within the exchange to the satisfaction of the assessor. And lastly, we received a number of inquiries from foreign jurisdictions that ask us, how did you achieve the outcomes of this assessment? Because the United States, for example, one inquiry was from the United Kingdom. They couldn't believe that South Africa is fully implemented in terms of some of these principles of IASCA, because it's very difficult to be fully implemented in some of these principles. So I think for South Africa, it is a great achievement in terms of the outcome of this ESCAP. And we will try and do our best to close the gap within the next year or two. In fact, this is in my specific department business plan to close a few outstanding gaps already this year.
So, Chair, just to conclude this opening before we get to the bills themselves, I think you'll see that there's a number of international conventions. You'll see that many of them are also new, and the standards also get tighter and tighter. So even if you complied 3 years ago, you can't rest on your laurels. You've got to do it. And in addition to the G20, we also now subject ourselves that in between the FSAP, we have a peer review, and there'll be a peer review done of South Africa's financial regulatory system to see that as G20 members, have we begun to implement, and often you don't have to have it implemented. If you say, this is our plan, it's going to take us 3 years to implement, and we will implement within that time. That's what they will look at. It's also, I think, as Norman has pointed out, or rather you know, for international investors, if we don't have these standards, you can be certain that people won't feel comfortable with investing. They need to know we have the highest standards, and in a way, if you, in our country, we need to almost be even tougher than the UK and the US if we really want to attract investment. So I think that's broadly the background. I don't know, Chair, maybe I should just pause and see if there's any general questions before Roy goes on to the credit rating agencies, because a lot of what we are saying also applies to the credit rating agencies. Well, it's there in terms of some of these commitments that we need. There might be different, you know, G20, the fact that you have the FSB, you have countries that we trade with that are already implementing, so he'll explain how the EU will look at our credit ratings. So we really have to do these things. Thank you. So, I mean, maybe if you want to just take some quick questions before we move on. I know it's been dealt with in a lot of detail.
Okay. I think in the interest of time, because we really need to make sure that
okay.
we have more time to discuss the two bills before what happens.
Okay.
But this is what I will appreciate if we are able to talk about the
first. Okay. So I will, I think
let's take a first decision on the first thing, and then I will allow for discussion and clarification.
Thank you very
much. Maybe first, before you proceed, Honorable Vandana. So I'll urge members to note down those questions. So after the two presentations, you are able then to deal with that.
So Chair, just to say, what we did was just to give you the background to financial reforms. We talked a lot about the financial markets, and I know that's why perhaps it's confusing. Yes. But now what we do is to give you the detail of the credit rating, the gory detail of what's in the bill, okay? And then we'll do the financial markets bill. Also the gory detail, like what's covered specifically in the bill.
Okay, then.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to deal with that moment, say the gory detail of the credit rating services bill. And just give you a brief overview of what the bill tries to achieve. We look forward to a more comprehensive engagement, I think, with the committee as we go through the bill clause by clause in later meetings with the committee. But I thought it would be just a good idea just to give you a bit of background and to highlight key issues in the bill that we've tried to address. And then we will also do a little bit of detail around investor protection, integrity and independence, and transparency and accountability. So, Chair, the purpose of the bill is to introduce new legislation. This is to provide for the registration of these agencies, for the control of certain of the activities of the agencies, conditions around the issuance of credit ratings, and then rules on the organization and conduct of agencies, and for any of the matters connected to the agencies. Roma has spoken about the financial crisis. One of the G20 requirements that President Zuma signed up to is that we will, as a world, as a globe, regulate credit rating agencies. And I'll come to why that's important and explain to you why these agencies are quite slippery creatures, and we sort of have to have a consistent approach throughout the world so that we can regulate them in all G20 countries simultaneously. And that is one of the agreements that the President signed up to, and I think it's a very good one for us to take forward. Then IOSCO has issued a statement of principles regarding the activities of credit rating agencies. So once again, they've set out a set of principles that we need to implement, and we have included those in our legislation. And then we have the benefit of being about 6 months behind the rest of the world in terms of legislation. We have specifically waited to see how the EU, the USA and Australia have dealt with credit rating agencies to make sure that we apply a consistent approach. The EU has what they call equivalency requirements, which is that if you issue a credit rating in another jurisdiction and you want to use it in the EU, so for example, if even South African wants to issue bonds and Moody's rates those bonds, then that credit rating needs to be issued in a country with the same laws and requirements as are in the EU. And the effect of that is that we need to create a system of regulation that is equivalent to that of the EU. And I think that's a very important part of the whole process of regulating credit rating agencies, because as I said, credit rating agencies are quite slippery. So all they need to do is move their operations out of one country into another and then issue credit ratings in another country, and then they're completely unregulated. And we have that problem generally with financial services. So you will have heard of countries like the Cayman Islands and the Isle of Man and Jersey and countries like that, where basically firms quite happily set up operations in a non-regulated jurisdiction, and then they can basically get up to mischief in these jurisdictions. And so it's very important that we implement a process of regulation across the world that dovetails in with each other's regulation. And so our bill aims to achieve that by meeting the EU's equivalency requirements. Then just to go on to a bit of a discussion around the activities of credit rating agencies. In South Africa, these are currently unregulated, but the Dodd-Frank bill in America has introduced regulation for it, and as I've gone to quite a bit about the EU's role. But some people would tell you that the credit rating agencies were the single only cause of the global financial crisis. I think that's a little bit of an extreme statement, but we have to admit that credit rating agencies did play a central role in the crisis, if only a role of not doing what they said they would do. So we know that Lehman Brothers, for example, was AAA rated until quite close to its collapse. And the AAA rating means that the firm is able to meet all its obligations and meet all of its debt repayments, and Lehman Brothers was clearly not able to do that. And if you look at the way that Lehman Brothers' income statements and balance sheets developed, you would see that the market was very clear that there were problems developing in Lehman Brothers. But the rating agency didn't move. So we need to make sure that they do their job better. They have a very important role in the global financial system. I'm sure they will come to the committee and plead their case, and they will tell you that they're just companies, and they just make statements on how people see debt, and people must just realize that they're not really that important. But in reality, they're actually more like auditors, in the sense that we trust them to do their job, and we trust them to do their job well, and we need to make sure that they do their job in an appropriate way. Then there's the issue of procyclicality of credit ratings. What basically that means is, as the global economy does very well and as economic growth takes off, credit ratings become better and better. And as soon as the economy begins to deteriorate very rapidly, credit ratings, people get downgraded very quickly. And to some extent, that almost creates a vicious cycle, so it's to some extent happening in Europe at the moment. And then there are potential conflicts of interest. Credit rating agencies provide consultancy services as well as rating services. This is not always a problem, but sometimes they actually provide consultancy services to companies about how to improve your credit rating. So you can go to a big three credit rating agency and ask them, what are the sort of things that we need to do to improve our credit rating? Pay them a lot of money, and then surprise, surprise, you get a good credit rating at the end of the year. We don't think that sort of behavior is appropriate. It's like going to your auditor and asking them for advice on how to come out with a good audit, and then they provide you with a good audit. And often credit rating agencies actually make more money from their consultancy services than from their rating services. And so it's very important that in the legislation and globally that we implement appropriate divisions between any consultancy services they provide and the rating services that they do. And I said that they play an important role and should be held to the highest standards. And then, very importantly for us, they're the cornerstone of other regulation. I'll get to some more detail about that in a second. And then our G20 commitments are in two parts. The first is that we need to create a globally consistent regulatory framework for agencies. So as I said, we need to create a bill and a regulatory set of regulations for these agencies. But secondly, we need to reduce the reliance of ratings in legislation. So I wanted to pick up a bit on more detail on that later, But for example, Noma spoke about the importance of pensions and protecting pensioners from bad advice. The Pension Funds Act, through Regulation 28, specifies that what we would like trustees of pension funds to do is that they need to invest the money appropriately, and we use credit ratings as a measure of how pension funds should invest the money. So we say, for example, that you need to invest at least so much of pensioners' money in AAA-rated instruments. So to ensure that we think that AAA shares and equities are good risks. Of course, that relies very heavily on the extent to which that AAA actually means something. So it is possible, there isn't regulation, it's possible that they can just say, well, they got a rating from somebody, they're not quite sure who, but that person says it's a AAA company, and so we can invest pensioners' money in that share. What we want, what we have now imposed, and I'll explain how that will work, is that pensioners will only be allowed to invest in instruments that are AAA rated, and then those AAA ratings have to come from a rating agency that is registered and is compliant with the Act. And that creates, I think, a very important component of the law. Okay, I'm just going to deal on two big issues in the Act. The first is jurisdiction and application, and the second is the question of liability. So there are three main agencies, Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's. They operate as true multinationals, so they try and, as far as possible, have different parts of their organization in different companies, countries. This is an example of one of the three. I'm not going to tell you which of the three, but it provides credit ratings of banks. So all the banks' credit ratings are done in a single place, and that's in Cyprus. And that is, means that actually Standard Bank is regulated, its credit ratings are issued from by people based in Cyprus. They do, as far as possible, try and include South African analysts in the process, but many of them don't have very large offices in South Africa. That immediately creates a risk because this is not done in South Africa. And then, for example, this company also does credit ratings and insurance companies, for example, it could be done in France. That immediately creates a problem for regulators because it means that a large portion of the work done by these rating agencies is actually done outside of South Africa. And so we need to make sure that the way that we regulate means that we can actually get hold of this credit rating agency if it makes mistakes and does things badly in a country outside of South Africa. And so we've had a lot of discussion about the creation of a South African entity, and that is now a requirement of the bill, and I'll go into a bit more of that on the following slide. So like I said, the key challenge is to create a framework where the regulation will actually have teeth without creating extraterritorial powers. And so in Section 4 of the Act, we require that a regulated person must, for regulatory purposes, only use credit ratings that are issued or endorsed by credit rating agencies which are registered in accordance with this Act. And that means that a regulated person can only use credit ratings that are issued and guaranteed and backed up by a South African-based institution. And that means that when Norman goes running after the credit rating agencies, he has somebody to go and run after and get hold of. And that's a very important part of the Act. So, for example, this applies to almost everybody. Under the Banks Act, if banks want to hold regulatory capital, that regulatory capital has to be AAA, and then the new Act says that that regulatory capital has to be held by a credit, that credit rating has to be issued by an agency that is regulated under this Act and has an entity in South Africa. I've spoken quite in detail about the Pension Funds Act, also the Collective Investment Schemes Act, which are unit trusts, and money market funds primarily, that also governs that. And the implication, as I said, is that regulated persons have to use registered credit rating agencies. However, we have not felt that it's necessary to expand this to private investors, and that is actually one of the G20 requirements, is we are not at all creating an act that says, well, once you're one of our regulated credit rating agencies, we think that you are perfect. We really must emphasize that it's very important for investors and private individuals and pension funds and the trustees and banks and anybody that invests in shares or bonds or anything, that they must do their own research and they must have their own, to some extent, have their own in-house capacity. I think one of the G20 outcomes is that we must try as hard as possible to move away from the system where if it's AAA, then it's fine and we don't need to worry about it. And so we are trying this act also to say you must do your own homework when it comes to investment. As I said, we've also, this creates, it's quite a tough regime that we've created, but what we've said is that we were going to follow the EU approach and allow for something which is called endorsement. And that is because it would become productive for us to require a credit rating agency to perform all of its activities in South Africa. And to go back to that previous discussion, it is a problem, to some extent, that credit ratings of banks are all done in Cyprus, but it's also quite an advantage. Because what that means, it means that they have one team that does credit ratings of banks throughout the world. So they compare our banks to banks everywhere. And we think that's a very important strength of a global credit rating agency. And we don't want to create a system where they actually use second-rate analysts to do banking regulation. So what we've introduced on slide 12 is this concept of endorsement. So because it would be counterproductive to require a credit rating agency to perform all of its activities in South Africa, and because the key strength of the agency is its ability to specialize and compare companies with similar companies in other parts of the world, we have created a concept in Chapter 4 of the Act, in Section 18, an entire chapter is dedicated to this, to say that the registered legal entity in South Africa can endorse ratings done by the same agency in another jurisdiction. So, for example, if Moody's issues a rating in New York on Standard Bank, then the Moody's office in South Africa can endorse that rating, and then South African pension funds and banks can use that rating in their activities. So the ratings may be used for regulatory purposes, but very importantly, if Moody's in South Africa takes that decision to endorse the rating, then the South African entity is liable for claims, and the South African entity is subject to Norman's oversight. And that means we do have somebody, we have a thing that we can run after if we do need to take it up with them. And it's perfectly within the powers of the Financial Services Board to terminate the license of Moody's to operate in South Africa, and that's quite an extreme step, but it is a possibility. So it is an internationally accepted way of going about this problem of rating agencies being throughout the world, and that's what we decided to use. Also, we have said that the compliance function and the back office support function can be outside of South Africa. That is something that is within the discretion of the registrar. So if the registrar feels that the compliance function is adequately done somewhere else, so globally, then he will allow that. So we don't necessarily require a compliance officer in South Africa, but it's perfectly within the power of the registrar to say that if he feels that the compliance function or the back office support work is not being done appropriately in another country, it's perfectly within his powers to say that that must now be done in South Africa. The second big issue, and Chair, you will be sent a number of very high-powered lawyers from the credit rating agencies, is the problem of liability. We spent a lot of time on deciding what the appropriate liability framework for credit rating agencies would be. The first draft of the bill prescribed quite a complex liability system, and we went through a substantial process of engaging with different experts on liability, and I'll explain what we have decided. But Chair, this is something that you as a committee must also apply your mind to, I think, in terms of what you think the most appropriate approach to liability would be. This is what we have come up with using independent advice, and if necessary, we can bring our experts with when we're going through the act in more detail. The credit rating agencies asked us that what they wanted is that if they met all the requirements of the act, then they should have no further liability to investors. That is one extreme of the system. We don't think that's appropriate. We believe that if you do not meet, if you meet all the requirements of the Act and you still act negligently, or you do stuff that's outside of the Act that we haven't necessarily thought of, then you should still have some liability. Other commentators felt, some were very extreme on the other side, and they said is that if you lost any money as a result of a credit rating agency making an incorrect rating, then the credit rating agency should cough up for that money. That is quite an extreme version also, because what that basically says is that the credit rating agency is your research arm. We don't think that the credit rating agency should be given such a high level of liability. We believe that you should, as an investor, also be required to do your own research, as I said earlier, and come to your own conclusion without always relying on the credit rating agency. So that's another extreme. After speaking to our legal advisors, and we really needed unbiased legal opinion on this, we decided to entrench the common law liability in the Act. And the reason for entrenching common law liability is that there is a well-established case law on the grounds for liability, things like negligence, maliciousness. In the law it's called intellectual culpability. And we have an enormous number of cases. We have conditions when this has taken place. We also have substantial case law on restitution and how restitution should take place. We have a history of when companies or agents where companies were out of the country, how we should go about finding liability for them. And so what we thought we'd do is we would not try and reinvent the common law. We would entrench the common law. And secondly, very importantly, we would not allow agencies, and there is a section in the Act, we would not allow agencies to contract out of their liability. So they are liable under the rules of dealings, firstly, and secondly, they are not able to have fine print anywhere in their ratings to say that if they are found to be negligent or malicious, then they are not liable. So it's a two-part to how we dealt with liability.
I think I should just add, I mean, this is an important point, because if you go to the extremes that Roy has pointed out and you make them liable, then basically they won't issue a credit rating, which means that investors, actually other investors, look to these. And so you'll find that fewer people would invest, because people, in fact, tend to believe, you know, an outside agency, not the company or the country over its own perception. So it's quite important to get the balance right, and I think just having the common law apply means that if they issue something maliciously, then they get in trouble, okay? If they don't follow the process, then they are liable. But to the extent that you offer advice, nobody knows everything, and any investor should know this is advice given in good faith, and it's still risky because nobody can predict that the share will fall or this or that will happen in a company. So I think it's important to get the balance right on this one.
Yeah. Okay, so then the other issues that we dealt with in the bill are investor protection. These are the standard requirements that we have in other parts of our legislation. Ratings need to be defined, reviewed, and updated in a timely, non-selective manner. You shouldn't publish a rating if a credible rating is not possible. There are requirements around communication, disclosure, and then there needs to be a slightly different system for rating structured products. These are very complex financial instruments. There needs to be disclosure around rating track records and the assumptions that they've used. So this helps investors when they're looking at the ratings, that they understand what a triple A means and what an A means and what an A minus means and what a double B plus means, so that you have a good sense of what all these letters mean. Prepare audited annual financial statements, and then importantly, empowering the Financial Services Board as the regulator and providing scope within the Act for them to work with their counterparts in foreign regulatory authorities. That's very important, because if these rating agencies operate cross-border, we need to ensure that the there is no accidental prohibition from the Financial Services Board knowing about what's going on in other regulatory authorities. And then I've spoken at length about the electoral liability issue and the contracting out. And that's part of investor protection. The second aim of the Act is around integrity and independence. So we require that, the Act requires that agencies must be organized in a way that their business interests, so those are their consultancy interests, do not impair the independence and accuracy of their ratings. There needs to be approval by the registrar if they want to provide services and ancillary services, and the registrar can say which services he will allow them to do and which ones he will not. Strict criteria for the endorsement of foreign issued or published credit ratings. Importantly, they must publish and adhere to a code of conduct, and we leave it within the power of the registrar to say which code of conduct they must use, and there is an international code of conduct, so the registrar can prescribe that they must apply the international code of conduct. They have to disclose where they get their money from, particularly the smaller credit rating agencies, and there is one particularly sort of small one that operates in South Africa and doesn't operate globally. We will require that they disclose to the registrar who pays them and what their sort of, to what extent they are dominated by one or two small firms. If you don't want a situation where you get one credit rating agency that basically gets all its money from Anglo-American and then gives Anglo-American AAA rating. The registrar needs to know the balance of how many firms provide these agencies with their compensation arrangements. And then I've spoken a bit about the historical default categories. Then in terms of independence and integrity and independence continued, we require effective risk management systems. We need to monitor that the organization has necessary knowledge and skills, protect confidential information. There needs to be thorough analysis of available information, so that they must come to an answer on their ratings where they have taken into account everything that they can take into account. We need to be sure that they apply rigorous and systematic methodologies. We need to ensure that they do take into account any macroeconomic changes in their methodologies, and we need to require that their directives are fit and proper, and that they have a permanent and independent compliance function. Importantly, we're not prescribing a methodology, so we do not say in the Act, and it's actually not within the registrar's powers, to say what or how the ratings agencies must go about coming to their answer. All we say is that you have to prove that your methodology that you use is in line with all of these requirements. And I think there it's very important that the registrar works with international other regulators, because it is actually a benefit that these ratings agencies work in a number of jurisdictions. So the more regulators you have overlooking their methodologies and checking what they're doing, the better. And then there's a requirement that around transparency and accountability, records need to be kept for 5 years, ratings agencies must provide the registrar with information, and he can ask for any information at any time. There must be disclosure around policy and procedures. I've spoken about the code of conduct, which also helps for transparency and accountability. And I've also spoken about compensation arrangements. That also deals with the internal compensation arrangements. So we can't have a system where if a rating agency issues a lot of AAA ratings, then everybody gets a bonus. Or if the rating agency does very well in a particular market and we find that they're doing very well because they have very lax standards, then the managing director gets a bonus. That's completely against what we're trying to achieve. And then importantly, that they must provide an annual report to the public. And here the public is everybody, but particularly the people that they rate, because they sometimes also have a little bit of a fight with the people that they rate, because people say we wanted a AAA, but we only got a BBB. And there needs to be some accountability to how they do their ratings to the public. We do need to also protect them in that. And then this just provides some ideas on their legal structure and ownership, their internal controls, and financial information on their revenue sources. So, Chair, I think I've done it very quickly because we are going to go through the bill, I think, in the hearings in a lot more detail. So, I'll just give you some of the highlights of what the bill covers. In the next two slides, I'm just going to give a chapter by chapter breakdown, which I'm not sure if members just want to follow in the bill that we've circulated. I think it was not today's intention to get into too much detail about the Act. But Chapter 1 provides all the definitions, as always, and the objects of the Act. Chapter 2 provides the conditions around registration, deregistration, and suspension. Chapter 3 is all about the duties of the agencies, their directives, methodologies, etc. Chapter 4 deals with the requirements around endorsement. Like I said, it's a very important area of the Act, and so it's got its own chapter. Chapter 5, also its own chapter because it's very important, is the liability provisions and the independence provisions. And then Chapter 6 is just a chapter dealing with day-to-day administration of the bills, the powers of the registrar and the deputy registrar, the rules, making powers, etc. Chapter 7 deals with enforcement actions and remedies, so you can use the enforcement committee and the civil action approaches. And then Chapter 8 provides for the regulation making powers rights, and then we have to amend only one act, I think, which is the Financial Services Board Act, and then just, you know, short title and commencement of the bill. So, Chair, that was a very quick summary of the bill, and we're open to take questions before we move on to the next bill.
Now we will be taking questions, clarification questions from members in relation to what the budget is. Member, this is your turn. Maybe like you said, the technicians, I mean, are very confused. We would appreciate that next time, if there are, because what happened with the story that is in the SSIS, so many and the science, but by the way, then if you go back and our books are so high that you can't even get the technicians. We appreciate it next time. And then secondly, going to the definition itself, if you look at page 7 of the Act itself, the Credit Act, where you're saying credit rating means the opinion regarding the creditworthiness rating of, then you mention everybody. Now I'd like to understand an individual, a person like me and you, when gets rated by banks or whatever, if you're not covered in that definition, if not, where is that person being covered? That's the question of the definition. And having your introduction, if you go to page, table 1, page 11, that's the principle 2, where you talk about the regulator. And they're saying the Minister of Finance has the legal authority to hire and fire board members and SSB executive staff. Isn't that going to create inconsistency as far as the ministerial rules are concerned, especially with the executive staff? Because executive staff are to account to the board. And the minister needs to monitor and evaluate the performance of the board. So it, that to me looks like it's going to create a confusion when now the minister will call the minister. I do understand, I do accept that the minister for me to be limited, because it's also an executive. But for him to monitor and evaluate executive staff, then I don't know, because it would be much better if the executive staff accounts to the board, then the minister can decide to evaluate and assess and monitor. And then, on principle number 3, this is the regulation, should
But if you look at that and you compare with what the late presenter said about the different things in the prophet, it's a bit confusing because there's the self-regulation, and at the end of the day, you'll find the very same DSE doing the assessment. Now, today they become the reference in the place. They are regulating and then you also do the assessment somewhere. Then you assess your own path. Then there's a problem. You are there and you are a reference. They will leave the boards unless they don't take the boards at least. I think I need to get the clarity on this one. The principle number 10, right towards the end, the agencies and policies and everything, and everything. I was looking at that one, Mumu, and saying to myself, what happened to the land bank, including principle number 2, if you merit it to the board and the minister? Because if you look at the land bank, you're not even sure where it's going to belong. The location of it is very difficult. There's no way to put it. And the minister, they're hiring and firing the boss. And they say there's a credit rating that is happening done by the land bank. Is the same act going to be applicable to the land bank? Are we going to have some collaboration within the two entities, which is the land bank and our bank, a credit rating standards and whatever? We're going to do the same? Now, if you go to principle number 8, I'm sorry to say that's how I said the effort because the chair was so long, I don't have the presentation. Principle number 8, the regulator, because the FSB is expected to do the inspection, investigation, surveillance powers. Now, when the FSB is doing this, it will be based on what standard? Because remember, the FSB is a regulator, such as the tax, and the JSE is supposed to self-regulate themselves, but the FSB is doing oversight. Now, here is an FSB going out to do the surveillance, doing the inspection, doing the investigation. Who's criteria is being used? Can I really go to your house and say, I've come to investigate your house. You decided to put the cupboard there, to put the furniture there. If it's your policies, it's your criteria, it's your standards, it's your regulation that you have used, that's the JSD. But actually, FSB then plays more of a lame duck responsibility. I don't know if you can just look at that and see how effective then FSB, because FSB is a regulator. How effective the FSB towards inspecting the JSD, towards doing the surveillance of the JSD. Because the JSD, the trend line is moving, the trade things, the commodities are moving, the trade relations are moving, everything is moving in the JSD. But FSB, we are as government, we are saying for the FSB that is supposed to do an oversight. But the only thing here is that doing an oversight on the criteria that has been set by the JSD, on the regulations that have been set by the JSD. But that creates confusion. Principle 12, where we are saying regulators should establish information sharing. Now, we are saying that, but on the other side, we are saying the EU, we need to, because we are within the global environment. We need to make sure that we adhere to the EU regulatory mechanisms. My question then is the information sharing. Do you take the cognizance of how does the profession build up into that code? present? How does it affect? What is the effect on it? What happens? And towards the end, say, the document, all documents, the credit and the movement that seems, it only speaks about investors, the company, the international investors or the foreign countries. It doesn't talk about individuals. I mean, because we also get rated by this one, the money, and it doesn't show anything. So can I get the clarity today? Because you find that the only time we see the public participation or the public involvement is only when we look at the annual report, when the annual reports are given to us. But annual reports they given to us as the public after what? I mean, it's like someone telling you to read the Bible when they've never been to the Bible, so you don't even understand what the Bible says.
Thank you very much for being considered. I hope Momo will have captured all that avalanche of questions and you respond appropriately to that. Members, I think I've allowed Honorable Bibana to proceed, but I think there's a temptation to bring the initial background presented by Momo into the presentation. But I thought the assessment report, I mean, will be linked mainly to the next presentation, which is on financial markets, because it deals with the securities market, our compliance to the international market. But I will be flexible, allow members to pose questions. I will be flexible in terms of managing those, but also I'll request Momo to obviously, if there are areas where they think they will be captured in the next presentation, they can help me that.
Yes.
Okay. I think we will members of course to emphasize that cautioning. But also, Momo, I think your relation was correct. This assessment report is starting to yield because for it, all of a sudden you are held accountable on some of the finance of the system. Thank you very much. In that order, I will allow Honorable Lenge to pose the question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair President. In the light of your comments, Chair, I would love to be maybe asking a general sweeping question or a comment, because maybe some of the questions that I have will be dealt with in the next presentation. But let me just appreciate the presentation of the session. It's really an eye-opener. And also for the fact that this ICC listing aspect is actually dominated by the black market of our country. We are all members of that. You don't know as to when do you graduate from that state. Our children are put there even before they start working. Therefore, a simple phone call that you receive and then you are given a cell phone without having signed anything. When you say I can pay for something that I did not order, only I received information that there is this kind of service. And then you are listed. I mean, when I was looking at this, especially on the credit rating, what my interest is more on the rating itself. And this presentation is actually responding to the questions that I have. To say the provision of explanation of the key elements underlining the credit rating that a member of the public, as the case may be, is able to understand how rating was arrived at, so that person is afforded an opportunity to justify or actually reject that particular rating. But you find that institution is just saying, no, you are blacklisted. who blacklisted me? For how much? No, 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 no. We don't give, we don't have that information. We just can't help you. And our people do not have such opportunity of engaging the institution, because that particular information can assist the president even to clear him or herself. But now that the information will be concealed, but you don't know if everybody is actually respected to get that information, because other people will say, I was given this this printout that I'm old, so and so, and in as far as I know, I cleared all these things. And then all of a sudden, you say, no, 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 your deal is actually true. I think this is a good response to the problem that our people are having, because this credit thing was actually now given to those that have. And those who do not have, do not fall within the category that can be given credit. So it means the gap between the haves and have not is actually widening through this tension.
The teeth to buy. That's the last second bullet thing on implication. Yes, they have to use rating agencies. So I want to find out the lifespan of those credit agencies in terms of operational. There is men who only go to the field that do they have the lifespan or they can operate until, I'm not sure, or on a renewal basis. But also, your last question, I think, I'm not sure if it's John, the one that I was presenting at the moment, I'm sorry. When you speak about the Kibon enterprise at this point, is there need to encourage what we call it private investors to do their own research and when they make investment decisions? So, you know, at times themselves might not be what it is in practice. And giving, are we giving any options besides research information in terms of the route, in case there might be fictitious information that can be used? Can they use the different agencies because we are here, yeah, yeah, I think I've kept that one. And I want to find out around that one, around the end. On page 9, there's one on integrity and independent control. You're saying experience to conduct credit services. It speaks about ensuring that at all times the organization has the necessary knowledge, experience to conduct credit rating agencies. So I want to find out the issues and how we do it overall. Are we doing, or are we just going to announce so many credits? I told them that I like them. In fact, I don't like it. It's important to have a business. So anyway, I just want to find out around that one. Is it, are we just open for that to participate in connected agencies? Are we regulating how many employees? So we're not able to monitor. So that's a particular problem. We're also for problems. Just the last one, I think it's only just the last slide in the fifth line. And on the bill aims to promote transparency around the transparency. And there's a bulletin on when they are requiring that each credit rating agency must disclose general nature of its compensations and arrangements. So I want to find out what are those compensations that are referring to the donation in a form of what? What are those compensations that are specifically about, and the last bulletin says each credit rating agent must publish annual report to the public, the way it includes inter alia, information of legal structures, the ownership, description of control, and so forth. And it says financial information on each revenue sources. So I want to find out around the costing. Can we maybe include an index to produce or rather percentage or interest that are allowed to accumulate and how much of that we expect? That is the fundamental point I wanted to ask. How much of that are we on this one? Are we going to share with them? Are we getting, is there anything that I'm going to be getting out of this process from them, or are we going to be sharing any percentage of what they accumulate if they consume? So that is one fundamental question that I want to stand out. What are we getting out of this process? Are we just going to leave it there? What we can teach them to go to? I think that is an approach from the around the ecosystem and the principles that is just to acknowledge and really acknowledge the fact that it's caused several pollutions, and I think I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nana. Momo, we can trust the
I think just strikes me, I think that I think we haven't done a good job, because I think there's a lot of confusion here about what credit rating agencies are. Credit rating agencies largely are like the big two is called Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and then you have Fitch. And then what's the South African one?
Global Rating.
Global Rating. That's it. Only have four, okay? And to the extent that these tend to be international, and Roy, just show your... like you had a nice diagram. You know, generally they tend to be, I think, Moody's is where? In the US. Standard & Poor's is... One is Europe, isn't it? The Fitch is European, the two are in the US. Mm. But they have branches all over. Okay. So you don't have too many coming in. Now what they do they also not the question the Honourable Member asked is they're not dealing with blacklisting and all of that. That, in fact, is covered in the National Credit Act that falls under the Minister of Trade and Industry. There's a National Credit Regulator. So the whole issue of people being given money, being blacklisted, that falls under that act. Credit rating agencies don't do that. What they do is they look at a company, and they look at the big companies like Anglo-American, etc., all the listed companies. They look at when government issues, we as government, bonds, okay, when you try and raise money. They will give you a rating. They'll say, this Anglo-American is AAA. It's able to pay for its liabilities. If you give Anglo money, you will get back, you know, there's a high probability you'll get back the funds that say you've loaned to them if you're buying bonds. On equities, they will take an approach on their ability to pay for their commitment. So what that means is, if somebody's got what they call a AAA rating, you know that if you're a pension fund, that you will invest those funds there, because it's a AAA rating, it's almost certain they will pay for their commitment. On the other hand, if you have a bad rating, like Greece or Portugal, so even countries they rate, that when it's a so-called junk bond, there's a high risk that they will not meet their commitments, or it's more risky. And that's why the more risky you are to try and get investors, you'll offer much higher interest rates or returns. So if you look at Greece, what's it sitting at? If you look at for their... Well, but if a bankrupt person comes to you, you say, I'll give you 100% return, okay? So you know now as an investor that in Greece, all the rating agency is saying that these guys are close to bankruptcy, they're not going to pay you. That's just put out there. You as an investor are saying, okay, these guys will probably not pay, but if they do pay, they'll pay me 500%. So I'm prepared to take the risk. Okay, and you invest in Greece. Okay. So, and so who is protecting other investors? It's the pension funds. It's individual investors who go to the JSE, buy an Anglo-American stock, that they don't go and buy blind. They can at least look at what is Moody's saying, what is Standard & Poor's saying, to inform them. Because some people, you can have all the advice in the world, they'll still not look at that advice and they'll still invest, etc. Okay? And what we're trying to say is, these credit rating agencies are also not God. When they say something is safe, because up to when Lehman Bank collapsed, they said they were the safest type of investment in the world, and they collapsed, okay? Which meant that their rating actually was of poor quality. They didn't really see the risks that clearly were there, okay? Similarly, if you look at we've had a negative outlook from Moody's, and now Fitch also, okay? The issue there is they're saying that our ability to pay, they've rated us an investment grade. Now they're still saying we might make the investment grade, but they're going to put they're going to reassess that rating. So these ratings are very important for pension funds, for even banks when they hold capital. They need to have what's called riskless capital. What Roy was saying, AAA. Okay, for example, some of those have changed. So they are only doing it to those people. Credit rating agencies just express an opinion on your ability to pay, okay? And of major companies, they're not interested in whether we can pay for our bonds and so on. That's done by the credit bureaus that you have. So they are a smaller form, but they regulate it differently. These are the people who deal with the big guys. Now, if you look at the principles that apply here, they don't apply to the land bank and so on. They apply to the regulators and supervisors. They apply to the FSB, they apply to the JSE as a regulator as well. So these are not issues around the land bank and so on, or state entities. When you look at the minister's powers there, it's that these entities have to be regarded as being independent regulators. If they issue a license to a bank or to an insurance company, I mean, anyone who comes into the financial sector needs a license. You don't just have a right to operate in a financial sector. What the FSB will do is that it will give you an insurance to say you can do the insurance business. Or in this instance, they will say for the capital markets to be a player, you need to be fit and proper, and for the JSE to regulate, to be an SRO, they have to meet their criteria. Not the JSE's. The JSE might set criteria, but it's set within what the FSB says should be the criteria. They can't go against what the FSB does. In fact, being the JSE, they tend to have the highest standards. So the FSB will have standards here, but if you want to be a listed company, you have even stricter standards because you have to compete with New York, with London, etc. Okay. So, and in fact, they're almost the least of our problems because when you list it, you are so transparent that your problem is more often the unlisted companies and what happens to them. So, I don't want to deal with the financial markets, but you'll see that it deals with market abuse, insider information, all the kinds of things that even on a listed stock exchange that you have. But be certain that even for unlisted, you might have similar sets of issues that come in. So when these principals say the minister can't fire, it means he can't fire Norman. Just because Norman says this company is not, or the JSE is not doing his X against the JSE, the minister shouldn't be able to fire him for doing his job. If the banking regulator says a bank doesn't have enough capital and asks them to have capital, and they go and lobby the minister to say, this chap, if he increases the capital requirements, will be able to lend less. The minister then says to the banking registrar, you can't do that. That's the kind of interference you can't have. And in fact, if you do interfere, then nobody will believe these guys. Anyway, and people won't actually trade on the JSE because they'll say the quality of their oversight is poor. Now, I don't want us to overemphasize these issues. I think it's the issues of independence of your supervisor, that they operate free from interference and aren't afraid they're going to lose their jobs just because they do their jobs properly. Okay, and it may be unpopular what they do. And those are issues that we've recognized and we're committed to. We're talking about the operational independence, and we're going to address those things in different legislation over the next 2 years. So it doesn't apply to the land bank, which is like a state entity. That's quite different. Okay. Although some of these issues could apply to companies in the sense that if you have a board, you want the board to have be the accountable authority. And what ministers say and so on is an issue. You don't want to undermine the board. In fact, then don't have a board. So there's different types of problems that you're dealing with. So I think I think just getting that perspective does answer quite a few questions, because the other questions will fall away. But to the extent that we come to the financial markets bill, and Roy is still going to go through that, it will answer, Chair, some of the questions. So I won't try and answer those questions. It will show you how we deal with the JSE and so on. I think just and what an SRO or like the JSE is, etc. I think the issue of inspection and so on is also covered in existing legislation. The FSB's got strong powers now of enforcement. So even if the JSE is an SRO, they can go and investigate it. They'll have stronger powers to investigate, even the JSE, if the JSE is not doing things properly. So, you know, you need to be afraid of these guys, and that's what's happening. I think that with regard to the other questions on, I've dealt with the credit listing, I've dealt with, when you look at the MOUs, the issue there is, if you own mutual, you're dealing with a regulator, the Financial Services Authority in the UK. Old Mutual is primarily listed there. They need to be talking to the regulators there. So it's an international practice that they talk to the regulators in the UK, because it's something that All Mutual does whilst it operates there. Or if Standard Bank is in, let's say, in the DRC, those regulators also want to talk to our regulators here to make sure that certain things that they do in the DRC is also done properly there. And they might need information from the South African regulator. So it's quite standard practice for them to have MOUs, which governs, which where they agree to share information and so on, about the company. There's big issues there. They're not easy issues, because you're talking to different foreign regulators, your equivalent. For all of them to do their work, they do need to share information. I think that the problem, so this is an issue around investors, and to the extent that, and Roy can answer some of the questions, when we talk about potential conflict, it's like auditors. When a credit rating agency, you don't want them to say Anglo is AAA rated because their main customer is Anglo and pays them a lot. That's why you've got to disclose your top 20, who are the people who pay, okay? So that's the compensation. It's not money the state is entitled to. These are companies. They charge for a service to that company. Of course, we charge them through taxes when they make profits. So, and to the extent that they do research, the investor can ignore it. You don't have to listen to their advice, because as with Lehman, they will prove wrong. So all we're saying is treat with care what they say. But to the extent that we can, we make sure that a credit rating agency doesn't give someone a good rating just because they're their main customer. So it's like, similarly, auditors, you don't want them to give a good opinion of a company because that's the company they'll audit this year, next year, etc. It's a lucrative business. And often they would do consultancy as well, in addition to credit rating. You want to separate those kinds of things. I don't know if you want to.
I think you covered it.
Okay. So that's a general framework. We're dealing with a different animal. It's largely only four companies. Of course, there were more credit rating agencies, and there are other smaller ones coming. That would be great, but at the moment, you're not dealing with a big pool of people. But when you come to the next world, you'll see with financial markets, you're dealing with many more people. So, Chair, maybe if we can answer some of the questions on the financial markets through Roy's presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'm aware that it's nearly 20 to 12, so and this is a very long bill, and I'm also aware that we will be seeing quite a lot of each other, I think, as we go through the details of the bill. So I'm not going to bore you with every single slide. I think I'm going to pick on the most important ones, and then we can discuss the details when we get when we come back. Just briefly, we're going to do the purpose of the bill, the objectives, policy and principal issues, the registrar's powers, and then, Chair, you spoke about market abuse and insider trading, and we have made quite a lot of improvements to insider trading provisions in the bill, and that's a very important part of the bill. Then we'll briefly pick on some of the changes we've made since the one that we published in August, and then some technical issues and then some legislative issues. But like I said, I won't go through all the slides. So if you'll just indulge me, I'll try and point you to the correct slides for us to look at. In terms of the purpose of the bill, we have already, I think, discussed this in quite a lot of detail in terms of the need to modernize our approach to financial markets regulation. I was researching some of the older bills that we used to have, and once upon a time, we actually, in the 1985 bill, we defined an exchange, stock exchange, as being a building, and the exchange as being a room within the building, and we said the registrar could say which building was the stock exchange. And that's a very, in the modern era of electronic trading and computer trading, it's a very old-fashioned way of looking at how stock exchanges work and how we buy and sell shares. So we have to keep up, so we have to regularly come back with new bills and new regulations, and that's part of this process. Just briefly on the process, and it has been an exhaustive and extensive process. Norman can tell you how many hours we have spent on reviewing the bill. We began with a review of the old Act, the Security Services Act in 2010 and 2011. That came about as a long process of relooking at our legislation. And in the middle of all of that, we had a global financial crisis, which made us relook at a whole bunch of different things in terms of how we should regulate. And we will, as soon as we finish with this bill and we pass this bill, which we hope to pass this year, I think in 2013 we'll start all over again and start preparing for the next bill, which we hope to have in front of you in 2018. So this is an ongoing battle to keep the legislation up to date with the markets. We published the bill for public comment, Cabinet gave its approval, and we published on the 4th of August. We took into account lots of comments. We had a public forum, we've had working groups, we've had meetings, consultative workshops, and we've finalized the bill early this year, and then we've now also the additional meetings with stakeholders, IDBs. I completely agree with the proposal from the Honourable Member that we must have a matrix of what all the letters mean, because I really struggle to keep up with all the acronyms. An IDB is an interdealer broker, and a PD is a primary dealer. Those are just market players. And then we are now ready to submit the revised bill to Parliament, and then I think that will be quite an extensive process. The main objective of the bill, we want to continue to increase confidence in South Africa's financial markets. Momo spoke about how important the fact is that we have incredibly well-regulated and stable financial markets is for economic growth and for development and for reducing unemployment. It's one of the key parts of the South African strength is our very, very strong financial markets, and we have to keep on improving them. We have to protect both regulated persons, so those are the people that operate on the exchanges, but very importantly, we need to protect the clients of those three people, so we need to protect everybody in the system. And that goes down straight down to the individual that has a pension or a share, investment in a money market fund. And if the system collapses at any point, then everybody loses their money, as the Greeks will tell you. And then reduce systemic risk, as I said, and then ensure that we have a competitive system and that we have a competition in the system. So that, I think, gives you a flavor of the main objectives of the bill. We think it's very important that the bill achieves these objectives, and we hope that in the process we will show that the bill does do those objectives. I'm going to come to a lot of detail about the issue of the JSE and the what we call the self-regulatory organization model. So, and there was a question about that from one of the members, and I think it was a very good question. So I'm going to skip to this slide. Just on slide 27, the policy and principle issues, there's this issue of segregation of securities and balancing the reconsideration. What happened early this year or late last year is one of the exchanges in the US collapsed. And what happened is that the exchange itself, as an exchange, and that was MF Global, the exchange actually took ordinary people's money and kept and intermingled it or confused it with the money of the exchange users to do its operations. And ordinary investors lost 1.2, I think the last number was 1.2 billion. Or we might have provided up to 1.5 billion US dollars. That it just actually, they use the term vaporized, because the money has just completely disappeared. And that is an important concept in all of this, which is that you need to segregate and divide up the money that an ordinary person puts into the exchange from the money of the exchange. And to entrench the rights of clients in the process and authorize users, and to ensure that there's a code of conduct for everybody that participates. And then a new section, which is quite a big shift forward in terms of implementing the Twin Peaks, and a very important shift forward, is that now there's a requirement for the registrar to immediately inform the minister and the governor if there is a problem on the financial markets that might have a bigger impact. We never actually before had that requirement, and we never had it before because we didn't realize how important systemic risk was. And as we develop the Twin Peaks approach to financial regulation, what we'll do is even improve this area of the regulation to make sure that the registrar is appropriately reporting any systemic risk issues to the governor, because the governor has ultimate responsibility in this area, and the minister, because taxpayers' money is always at stake. And so this is a very important step forward. And the JSE needs to inform the registrar in turn, because obviously the registrar can't keep tabs on absolutely everybody. So if anybody knows about the same groups, then they have to tell the registrar, and if there's a contravention of the act, if they don't. And then I'll deal with a little bit about new business later on. Okay, I'm going to skip through the next few slides. Just on slide 29, a new thing, which is what we call a securities ownership register. The system, strangely enough, and it's quite an interesting aspect to the system, we have one of the best systems of keeping track of what who owns what in the financial system, but we don't actually have a proper centralized securities ownership register. Often, if you own a share, you actually that share is often held at the JSE on your behalf by another company. And what we want to do is move towards having a securities ownership register where your individual ownership of a share will be recorded somewhere. It's quite a substantial improvement in how we do share ownership, and I think it's an important one. In the interest of time, let's move on to another very big thing.
Those things are important, because what this does, and there's a lot of segregation of funds, is to make sure that if you invest, one, your funds are protected, that it's clear that, you know, who owns the shares, so that even if your broker runs away somewhere to Australia, or lots of them go to Australia, or wherever, that at least the ownership is not challenged, and you still maintain your ownership over it. So, you know, those are very important protections. And remember that a lot of this would apply to pension funds. So it really does affect ordinary people's investment.
Mm. Then, Chair, there's the question of over-the-counter derivatives. On the following slide, on slide 51, I've given you two pictures. That is since 1998 to 2010. Just showing you the explosion in derivative transactions in the world between about 2004 and 2008. And these derivatives are strange financial instruments that create enormous risk in a financial system. They do things and increase exchange rate volatility, because people buy and sell particularly exchange rate related derivative instruments. They impact how interest rates move. They also impact commodities. And there is a very good report out by OSCO on how we can improve the regulation of commodity markets. And commodities in this case is not only gold and platinum for us, but also maize and corn and food futures and food derivative instruments. And there's been a lot of discussion in the G20. There's a whole area of work around the extent to which speculators might be driving up food prices. The G20's research shows that they don't think that speculators are driving up food prices, and it appears to be more of an issue of demand from China. But we do need to watch this. We do need to make sure that there isn't the potential for this to take place.
But Ryan, I just want to point out, so I think there's great risk, but they are all these instruments have benefits as well. But this one is more of a more dangerous nuclear bomb. It's got benefits, it smoothens risk and transfers it, etc. But you don't know what's inside it. When it explodes, you can be hurt. So you need, just explain that, because it's, you know, you've got two sides. So the issue is not then to ban derivatives, but how do you regulate it?
Yeah. Yeah, my mother makes a very good point of that, particularly food security and food derivatives have really contributed to us ensuring that global food is distributed around the world, because these derivative instruments allow for people to hedge and to reduce the risks of crop failures and flooding, for example. So it is a very useful system, and I think that's why it has been so successful.
But just to be clear, you're not reducing the risk of crop failure.
No.
When there's when there's crop failure, you reduce your exposure.
Yes. And so basically, as Mama said, a very important point is we just need to know what's going on. And we don't think that this is creating volatility at the moment, but one does need to know what is going on. And it's important to point out that actually the types of derivatives that are most popular or most important are interest rate contracts. On the left-hand side, the purple one is interest rate contracts internationally. And on the right-hand side, the dark red one, the second from the top, is interest rate contracts in South Africa. And those are very important. They create a very deep and liquid market in our government bonds. They ensure that we can issue government bonds and that they can be traded. And so we're not going to ban those ever. But we do need to at least monitor how they work. And so just to go back one slide, the Financial Markets Bill takes a big step forward to actually prescribe standards, code of conduct and reporting, and clearing and settlement standards for these derivative instruments. We are creating what we have to do in terms of our G20 requirements is a trade repository, so we can get reporting on derivative transactions so that we know what's going on. They need to disclose this information to the registrar and to any other relevant supervisory bodies, and that will probably include the Reserve Bank. And we are currently finalizing quite a comprehensive discussion paper on how we want to take this forward, which we hope to release within the next month or two. So I think that's quite a big area of work for the G20, and the bill needs to take forward better regulation of derivatives. And we will hope to have some kind of framework in place by the end of 2012. These are just technical amendments which we'll get to when we go into detail, so I'm going to skip them and move all the way on. Let's go to slide 35. This links to some of the principles that Mama discussed in the earlier part. One of them is the ability of the registrar to prescribe fees without having to ask the Minister of Finance's approval. We have created a system within the Act that will allow that to take place. And this strengthens really the ability of the registrar to act appropriately, and the FSAP, that's those principles, that's how we introduce it. I think Norman has spoken about the amendments to listing requirements. Then on slide 36, we have also allowed for the regulation of unlisted securities. So when you decide to issue shares in your company, you don't necessarily need to do that through the JSE. You can do it outside of the JSE, but then that's often very unregulated. So we have allowed for the Minister and the Registrar working together to develop policy on this and to issue regulations around this. Then we will come to, I think, a big discussion about this in the hearings, but just ensuring that foreign participation in markets is appropriate. We very much want foreigners to be involved in our markets because they provide a lot of cash for us, and it's important for our firms to raise capital. But we need to be very aware that foreign participation also brings risks to the system, and so we have enhanced how we balance the risks from the global financial crisis. Foreign participation in the markets. And then slide 38, improvements to the accountability of the registrar. He now needs to make public his reasons for any deviations, and he has to comply with the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Then, Chair, we had a very good question from one of the members on the JSE being both a player in the financial system and a referee. It is a big problem, and it is something that came up a lot of times in a number of the submissions that we had in the first round of public comments, and I'm sure it will come again during the process of public comments that you will receive in the committee. We have a system where the JSC, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, and Strait is a sort of a child of the JSC in the sense that they used to be part of the JSC, but they've now been spun off, and they do all the, they monitor who buys and sells shares. They don't do any of the buying and selling, but they provide a service to the system. And we have these things called self-regulatory organizations in the sense that they write the rules for the exchange, and they have to present those rules to the registrar, and the registrar has to approve them. But as I said, they do in some senses, and in certain parts of the market, they are both players and referees. And this act proposes to substantially strengthen our oversight over them and to give more power to the SSB, and particularly around potential conflicts of interest. We now have proposed a code of conduct. That is that these exchanges must have their must publish a code of conduct, and they must on potential conflicts of interest, and they must have a very transparent approach to mitigating any conflicts in their role as both regulator and a profit-making business entity. They also, we've introduced minimum requirements for stakeholder engagement. They cannot make rules without consulting the industry, and then they can always go to the registrar and ensure that he doesn't approve the rules. So that creates a new system of strengthening our oversight of them. And then I've discussed the requirements of the SROs to report systemic issues to the registrar. This all then takes a big step forward in improving how we ensure that the JSC is appropriately regulated as itself. But we would like to, as part of our overall shift to 20, we are going to do a much more comprehensive review of the SRO model, and we will discuss all the costs and benefits. I think it is very important at this point to highlight that the JSE has been very successful. We have one of the best regulated capital markets in the world, and the JSE got the prize for the number one exchange internationally. It is a very good exchange. They do a very good job. So we don't think that there are going to be huge changes to how we do the system, because it's working, so let's not change it. But we just must make sure that we don't slip up in our own oversight of them. Next year, you started off and you highlighted issues around market abuse and how insider trading is creating problems. We have, in the last few years, Norman might want to give some examples, discovered that people do very strange things when it comes to insider trading. And so we have actually made more offences in the Act. So we've taken away two outdated offences, which are effective transaction and dealing on behalf of a public sector body. It is now an offence if you're dealing on behalf of a public sector body. I think you should be subject to the same rules as you would have been if you were dealing for another body. We've created a new defence. So you may, if you have the same level of inside information as somebody that you're trading with, then you're both equally insiders, and so we don't think that it's all that much of a problem. So it's a defense. It doesn't mean that you're exempted from insider trading, but you may have that as a defense when we take you to court. Then we've created a new offense, and that is if you deal on behalf of an insider, if a person knew that such a person was an insider. So if you go to your broker and you say, I want to buy and sell shares in Standard Bank, and your broker knows that you are the CEO of Standard Bank and that Standard Bank is about to release its results, then the broker is also liable for insider trading as an offence. So that's a very important new offence that we've created. And then we've created an additional price manipulation contravention so that if you have a reason to suspect that there's manipulation taking place on the financial markets and somebody comes to you and says, don't you want to be part of this manipulation, and you are part of it, then you have committed an offense. Previously, this was not a contravention.
Yeah, I mean, if you just observe, I mean, insider trading is one of the biggest problems you face on any exchange, and it's very hard to enforce because it can be just a wink and a nod. If you look at this case, if I can't pronounce his name, but in the U.S. where they charged this guy, he got 20 years. You know, it was like people right at the top making calls. They had to tap people. Very hard to do that unless you have pretty strong powers to investigate. Not, I mean, they won't have those kinds of powers. You have to get the prosecuting authorities involved and so on. So it's a big area for all exchanges in the world. No.
Okay, then we've done some other things. So we've taken away the compensation orders, and because it's often impossible to identify persons and quantity losses, so it's very hard to discover how much people have actually lost as a result of insider trading. And people say, well, no one actually lost. We insider traded, but no one actually lost any money, so that's really a problem. We think that that has been taken away. So it is possible to identify victims. Then, I think those are all self-explanatory. The main ones are market abuse and dealt with. And then these are just the final parts of the Act. We just need to align with the Reserve Bank Act, the Banks Act, the Financial Payment System Act, the Financial Intelligence Act, and the Consumer Protection Act. I'm on slide 44. That's just because these acts have been developing themselves over time and we need to keep up with them. I'm not going to go into the additional provisions. These are highly technical things which we can discuss during the hearings, as is slide 46, which is very technical on auditors. Then on legislative alignment, on slide 47, Mohammed has spoken about the need for us to align all our financial market legislation to the Companies Act, the new Companies Act, so we have done that. Then there's the issue of ensuring that financial services are held to a high standard, and so we need to design a system where actually we have higher standards of consumer protection for people that use financial services. Then there is the need to, Norman went into a lot of detail on the unitary provisions principles and the amendments of the Insolvency Act. We've had a lot of discussion with the Justice Department on this, so we are quite happy that we are proceeding correctly. Then there's small amendments, I think, to the Competition Act to make provision for minister certification. That's just a technical amendment. And then the phase is the Financial Advisory and Intermediary Services Act for removal of references to there. And then there is the need for ensuring that the right act applies at the right time, and so there is a provision in the Act dealing with that. I've come to the end of the discussion on what the Bill tries to achieve. Only 2 minutes over, I'm quickly going to give you a summary of the chapters, and that is Chapter 1, the definitions, Chapter 2 with the powers and functions, 3 with licensing and functions, 4 with custody and administration, 5, I'm not going to go into too much detail because it's quite a long act. We can grind through it when we get to the hearings, I think. I think that is the end of the introductory presentation.
Thank you very much, Momoy. I think we need not to depend that much on how the whole thing is set up, because we're speaking this is more on introductory risk, more especially on the credit rating agency. It's a new initiative, and I think this rating is just meant to introduce the market. But simple things, at the beginning there might be those rudimentary kind of things around the agencies and how individuals are affected. But going forward, I think members will be able to go through a political production and familiarize themselves with the content of the bill and get us ready, I mean, for more deliberate engagement with the other people that are finally with yourself. So that simply says we are at the beginning, and I don't think we must stress about some of these petty confusions that today.
Yeah.
I don't think that we didn't do ourselves. The communication has been very simple to continue and our conference. So members, the presentation, or maybe the presentation on the security matters has been done. So we please have some clarification questions if there are any.
Roy can answer the first three, but just on SROs, and Norman can come in. There's different models that apply, but generally I think they tend to be self-regulated, but with different degrees of self-regulation. So I guess it would depend on what aspects you self-regulate. I think the reality, and I mean Norman and would really know this better, maybe you should come in, is in practice, you know, there's, what, we've got about 400 listed companies, right? There's a lot of work that goes in, a lot of very detailed regulations for listings. They have to compete with New York, etc. So there's a lot of nitty-gritty types of things that have to be done to run the JSE. And it's in that capacity that they tend to regulate. But of course, you could argue that once there's a case of insider trading, that it does go beyond that, and other authorities could come in at different points. But you want to make sure that they make sure that the members of their club abide by the rules, and they're not absolved, because at the other extreme, if they have no regulatory responsibility, then the incentive is almost not to comply and protect the reputation of members. So it's like an exclusive club. You know, every member worries that somebody else, if their standards are down, then it means their standards, when they go to investors, may not be as good as they would hope when getting funds from the markets, etc. So there's pretty strong incentives for them to comply. But I don't know if Norman wants to add in with international practices, because the type of SRO can also differ. And if you look at it, IOSCO has got principles and sort of papers on these things about how it's done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there is an IOSCA principle on child regulation. You can't just allow child regulation and expect the exchange to just regulate itself and regulate the system in Pretoria, and the exchange is operating in standard. It's more a type of a mutual regulation, not for co-regulation. But the IOSCA principle is also very specific and clear that you can't allow your self-regulation if the regulator doesn't have all the measures in place to proactively address possible conflicts of interest. I can remember when we demutualized the exchange a few years ago, and even worse, when we allowed the exchange to list on itself, one of the main focus by the regulator, the Financial Markets Board, was to identify all the possible conflicts of interest and make sure that we address those conflicts of interest to the satisfaction of the regulator. So there's a very close interaction between the regulator, the FSB, and the JSE. You know, we attend all their meetings from the top, the board meetings, we formally assess themselves, or the FSB assess them on an annual basis, very detailed in terms of the legislation. So they can't just do whatever they want to do. And there's a clear distinction between the role of the exchange and the role of the Financial Services Board. The question was raised about inspection, for example. In terms of the Financial Markets Act, there's a requirement that the exchange must have all the measures in place to take action, disciplinary action, against its members if there is a contravention of the rules of the exchange. So the main focus of the exchange is to ensure at all times compliance with its rules and its directives. And we, as the FSB, must approve those rules. We must be satisfied that those rules will be in the interest of investors' protection. The exchange can't take action against the member firm in terms of a contravention of the Act. That is the role of the Financial Services Board, in terms of insider trading, for example, in terms of market manipulation, in terms of misstatements by listed companies. That is the role, in terms of the Act, of the FSB. Although we work very closely together, our unit, our Directorate of Market Abuse, on a daily basis, work very closely with the JSE to proactively identify any possible forms of insider trading in the market or market manipulation. And those cases are reported to the FSB forthwith. And we take action, the FSB, our enforcement committee, not the JSE. The JSE is there primarily to enforce the rules of the exchange on a daily basis on its member firms. And the FSB has got very extensive inspection powers. If we expect any contravention at any time by a member firm of the JSE, we can get into that member firm, of course, in close consultation with the JSE, to inspect that member and to identify any possible conflicts or contraventions of the legislation. So it's not actually self-regulation, it's more co-regulation in consultation with us. And there are very strict requirements in terms of regulation that we expect the exchange or any SRO, in terms of the Act, an exchange is an SRO, a Central Securities Depository is an SRO, and the Independent Clearing House can also act as an SRO. But you can't just act as an SRO if you are not in a position to fulfill the very onerous duties and legislative responsibility to act as an SRO to the satisfaction of the FSB.
Okay.
But in the terms of the discussion, we will more expand on the role of SRO vis-à-vis the Financial Services.
But yeah, I mean, I do think that question, and we're spending time because I think it's a very important question. And what we're saying is, in a way, this is an exchange, so it's not a company. And so you have certain standards. And in a sense, to become an SRO, you have to have very high standards than normal. And that doesn't mean that there aren't potential areas of conflict, because like Norman's outlined, the fact that for example, the JSE lists on its own exchange. There are issues. So even when we talk to the JSE, we have to say, we're talking to you as a regulator. You can't go and tell your company as a JSE X, Y, Z, because they almost have an insider advantage as a company. So there are difficult issues, but that this is the general practice with exchanges, yes, but it's not exclusively so. There are differences. And I think what we'll do, because just to show you what the case is for other major exchanges, they do have issues where if you look at the New York Stock Exchange, it is also listed on its own exchange. We take the London Stock Exchange, it's also listed. So there are potential conflicts, and you can never take things for granted. But I think what we'll do is perhaps just give you a table of and show you what the practice is across. And there are difficult issues that we are trying to grapple with in these respects. Do you want to answer the other? Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I still think I have to answer the questions around systemic stability. I have a proposal on how we could amend it. I think that was a good proposal, and we'll definitely think through that. In terms of the model for OTC derivatives, what we are probably going to move towards, the consultation paper puts out a number of options. What we are probably going to do is do quite a phased process, so that we do carefully and step by step. The first part of that would be to create this reporting requirement, and we will begin with the ones that we know about the most. So we will start with interest rate contracts and those things, and then they will have to be reported to the trade repository. We still need to decide how the trade repository will be set up and who will take the responsibility for that. We set out a number of options in the paper, which we will consult some of the industry. There are issues in terms of, this is a very important information, it's very market sensitive information, so you have to be very careful how we deal with that. And then the last question, I think, was on interest rate contracts, if I'm correct, those are mainly actually to do with bonds, the most simple interest rate contract is that you can buy, you can go to your bank and you can take out a home loan on a fixed interest rate, and so the interest rate doesn't change over the course of the loan, and that's a fixed interest rate mortgage. And then another type of mortgage, which is the one that most of us have, is a variable rate mortgage that fluctuates from time to time. And then what happens is that Standard Bank will sell you a variable rate mortgage, and then another company will sell you a fixed interest rate mortgage, and then there needs to be a contract between those two companies to make sure that those two are the same. And that is an interest rate contract. It's a type of derivative. It's, as I said, a very important derivative. And that ensures that the two rates broadly follow each other. So it's like an instrument in the background that ensures that interest rates are equally the same between each other. It's a very straightforward, simple a derivative, and that's why it's very big. So we can start with just requiring that firms report the amount of interest rate swaps that they write, and that will be our first step in terms of regulating this.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The money in my state, I think we have realized what we set up and to achieve at the beginning of this meeting. To introduce this concept to members as to what is entailed in the two estates. But also, members, indeed, our endeavor to realize what one can term a safer financial sector environment in our country, but not also in our country. Because we are not operating in our country. I mean, what we do in our country affects what happens to the country. What is happening in other countries, of course, is affecting our operations and the reference to issues that are significant, very critical. I mean, for us, we have a conducive environment. I mean, for the financial sector to prevail, or maybe the financial sector to operate.
And I think for the purpose of this engagement, which was mainly a brief and informal briefing on the two bills, we have realized that people. Going forward with giving members, there are key issues that we need to grapple with. In the area, the issue of how do we ensure that there is appropriate legislative alignment, as cited, I mean, between the financial regulatory framework. And it calls on us also to start identifying those areas that need to be perfected in order to ensure that some of these tests, I mean, corroborate each other. So we need to also look at the possibility of engaging other committees or maybe having joint sitting in a fire to this legislative alignment aspect is concerned. And secondly, very, very critical, the issue that you raise around the CRA on the liability. I think that's going to be interesting to get the opinion of our stakeholders on this matter. And I think with what you have obviously taken us through, we are properly prepared, I mean, to compare your view and the views of other stakeholders on this matter and ultimately come to a very helpful and a conclusion. And I think really for today, remember, we were taking through this particular exercise, and it was a very helpful exercise, very informative, and for that we thank you, and we hope to see you very soon around these two bills, you know, because really we need to move on some of the areas, or else we will be caught napping, because development are extremely
Okay. 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 Ok